I want to talk to you about something more serious nature, something that is often misunderstood and misrepresented. It's something that is dodged and denied. It's discounted. It's derided. It's disregarded. You know, everyone has it, but few admit it. And folks, you can't solve this one with education. It doesn't respond to money, government programs, or antidepressant drugs. It cannot be obliterated with good works. Comparisons cannot elevate you above it. You can dodge the truth about it for a while. You can even deny its existence. You can blame it on someone else. You can blame it on the environment, your genes, your parents, your teens, the terrible twos, or the depression blues. That has the makings of a country and western song. I think if we just threw in a dog and a transport truck, we'd be all set. Now, you may be too young to know it or too old to remember it, but it's still there, and that's because it is hereditary. It's as old as Adam, but as recent as today's news. It's out there, and it's among us here. It's all around us and in us and through us. The fact is, you and I cannot escape it. Destroyed a world that was, it threatens a world that is. And you can criticize those who point it out. You can even tar and feather them and run them out of town. You can psychologize it, euphemize it, rename it, defame it, or simply cover it up with positive thinking. But it's still there, living out its deadly life, breathing its toxic breath, waiting just beneath the surface of your life to try and destroy you. It's the subject of the world's most widespread cover-up. It exists in both jailhouses and White House, on the highest hilltops, and even on our own Parliament Hill. It exists in both barroom and boardroom. Saints and seers who announce it are also beset by it. Its presence, so universally experienced. Its existence, so universally ignored. More indelible than the darkest stain. More lethal than the deadliest nerve gas. More terrifying than the most twisted horror movie. Yet most willing to be ignored as it goes about its work. Folks, it is fatal in both large and small doses. And here's the kicker, it's not even a four-letter word. But it is mankind's dirtiest secret. What am I referring to? None other than sin. That's right. And I'm sure most of you had already figured that out. And I'm also sure that more than a few of you might be thinking, oh, Pastor John, do we have to go there this morning? Let's not talk. Isn't there something better you could address on this fine Sabbath morning? Look, it's fall, and the leaves are starting to fall, and they're starting to turn, and the geese, I was out yesterday, and the geese, they're starting to fly in formation. It's so beautiful. Sure, I've got a few aches and pains, but life is generally good. I've been paying the bills. We've got more than abundance to eat, and it's almost Thanksgiving with all the turkey and the fixings. I got a feeling so good today, and now you're going to spoil it. Besides, don't you have anything better to pin on me than that? Now, maybe I should have stayed home and read the Sunday paper. Now, I don't blame you if that's how you feel. Nobody, myself included, likes bad news, even if it's the truth. But as is often the case with a sick patient, we have to hear the bad news, and I've said this before, we have to hear the bad news of our condition before we can hear the good news of a cure. Only the sick need a physician, and the plain truth of the matter is that each and every one of us here this morning is sick. Now, if you don't like my diagnosis, I don't blame you, because to be totally honest, I don't like it either. I don't. That's why I'm going to rely on someone with far more authority and expertise to step in and give us the prognosis. His name's Paul, and he's an apostle of Jesus Christ, someone who's been set apart for the gospel of God. And writing in the third letter of his letter to the Romans, beginning at verse 10, he says, and I'm going to read it to you this morning as if I'm having a dialogue with him. So tell us, Paul, what is the truth about our dirtiest little secret? Well, John, let me tell you, as it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. And the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Mercy sakes, Paul. I didn't think, as one of my pastor friends used to say, Lord, love a duck, Paul. I didn't think it was that bad. Are you telling us that this ugly description even applies to us too? Or was it just for those living back in your day? Yes, John, it really is that bad, and sorry, but it does apply to everyone living in your day too. In fact, it's applied to every generation since Adam. It is God's universal verdict on all those made in His image. Paul, I'm guessing that some of us here had no idea that it was that bad. I'm thinking some of us have yet to realize that we're far worse off from God's perspective than we ever imagined. I know, John, but it's the truth, and we need to let it sink in. Now, John, I also want you to know that God is far more gracious than most of us have ever imagined. If I can just bring you to realize both, then you can see that God will be able to do a wonderful work in all of you. He can change your life and your heart like you never dreamed possible. Read my letter, John. Explain it to them. Explain what I mean. Okay, Paul, I'll do my best. Now, if you're joining us for the first time this morning, or you've been away for a while, we have been studying Paul's letter to the Romans. And so far, we've covered the first two chapters, and as I said in the introductory message a few weeks ago now, we're only going to be able to scratch the surface of all that this letter contains. So again, I just want to encourage you to be studying it on your own. Well, today we come to chapter 3. As I said, we've already covered a fair bit of ground, but let me just give you a quick review. So far, we've seen that the Gentiles, and those are the non-Jewish people that made up the majority of the world's population before Christ, though they thought they might have had an excuse for turning their backs on God, the truth is they really didn't. And the same is true today. You see, God has given enough evidence in the world around us. And in addition to that, a written moral code in their conscience, which is sufficient to convince anyone of His existence, whether they've read the Bible or not. When they show up in His courtroom and plead not guilty because of ignorance, He is going to say, plea denied. You should have known. You're without excuse. Paul's also shown us in the first half of chapter 2 that even all the morally good people that have come along in man's history, you know, those who've blessed the world with their great humanitarian deeds, well, Paul says they're also without excuse. See, the truth is, you, you can't please God and earn your righteousness on your own either. Now, that comes as a surprise to some, but do you remember the message a couple weeks ago? You may be good, but you're not good enough. And that's because our judgment is not a trial by a jury of our peers. Rather, it's a prosecution by a judge whose standard is absolute perfection. In fact, in his courtroom, nobody but the fully innocent are acquitted. And we're going to see today that no human being is in that category. What we've seen too is Paul showed us in the second half of chapter 2 that dedicated religious people like the Jews, with a 2,000-year history of association with the God of the Bible, we're going to see that they're not right with him either. Yes, they focused on their outward rights and their religious privileges diligently, but they didn't meet the standard of his law. And as such, they're without excuse too. They can't please God through their own efforts. Now you would think with a succession of hits to the solar plexus of self-justification like these, that the snap would be gone from everybody's suspenders. But again, Paul shows us that he knows human nature. He knows that we'll run from exposure of this dirty little secret for as long as we can, and that's because it's in our fallen nature to deny it. Last week's message, Paul identified a couple of perceived rights that the Jews thought they had. You see, they expected special treatment from God, and they expected to be blessed for them, but Paul is showing them that they missed the boat completely. The truth is that it is hard to tell a religious person that they're wrong. What we find is that it's like Paul anticipated their objections, and he does his best to point them out. And the first one that he anticipated them saying was, "What about our birthright? What about our birthright?" You see, they felt that as Jews, as God's chosen people, as Abraham's offspring, that they had special insider rights that would guarantee them entrance into heaven. And we see that in verses 11 to 24 of chapter 2. And Paul's response to this objection is found in verse 13. That's where he says it's not just the hearers of the law who will be declared righteous. It's the doers of the law. It's those who obey perfectly. And in that regard, the Jews failed miserably. And then the second objection he anticipated coming from them was this: what about our religious rites and practices? I think we've all got our sacred cows, don't we? We see that in verses 25 to 29. We saw him argue effectively against that as well. In the parallel of the river from week 1 in this series, we saw that that parable I read you? We saw that the hut-dwelling brother can't say, "God will overlook my wrong because I didn't know." And the judging brother can't say, "God will overlook my sin because it's not nearly as great as somebody else's." And the rock-stacking brother, as commendable as his acts of service are, he can't earn his way back to God through his own efforts. Paul said at the end of chapter 2 that to be truly right with God requires a circumcision of the heart by the Spirit and by Him alone. That's in verse 29 of chapter 2. Well, in today's text, it's as if Paul is anticipating a further chorus of objections. And he basically keeps right on swinging from where he left off last time. Now, objection 3 would go something like this: if what you're saying is true, Paul, then we're all in the same sinking boat. If that's true, then what good is it to be Jewish? And you can see that objection raised in verse 1. What advantage then is there being a Jew, and of what value is there in circumcision? And I like Paul's answer. His answer is that there actually was a real special benefit for being a Jew. And you can see that in verse 2 where he says, "much in every way." first of all, they have been entrusted with the very words of God. In other words, you Jews were chosen as a very special vessel to receive and to care for God's written word. Now, he's going to elaborate on the subject of God's future treatment of the Jews in chapters 9 and 10, but that's beyond our scope for this morning. But let me just make one quick application to this. Folks, we in the Western world, and in particular, we here in North America, we have the Word of God in abundance. I think I've heard a couple different people in the last little while from this pulpit say that the average household has at least 6 Bibles in it. I was curious, and so I opened up the Bible program that I like to use, and I discovered that I have 33 different versions of the Bible at my fingertips. 33. Now, if you believe the statistics of most households having at least 6 Bibles, and you watch the 6 o'clock news, you have to wonder what in the world people are doing with those 6 Bibles. It would seem they don't spend much time reading them or applying the truth found in them with, you know, to their lives. But in many ways, over the last couple hundred years or so, think about us here in North America. God has used us as a repository for His written word. It has been a great privilege for us. But again, please note that doesn't give us any special privilege in judgment. The fact is that the same standard will judge us that will judge the rest of the world. Actually, it may be that we will even be judged more strictly. Because we're told in Luke 12:48, from everyone who's been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who's been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. See, being blessed and used by God doesn't change the standard of judgment. That brings us to the fourth possible objection Paul anticipates from his readers. It goes like this: if some among us failed, does that mean that God is going to take the blessing away from all of us? In other words, do a few bad apples spoil the whole bunch? You can see that objection raised in verse 3. He says, what if some did not have the faith? Would their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? And then we see Paul's answer in verse 4. Not at all. Let God be true and every man be a liar, as it's written, so that you may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. You see, what wasn't being considered by those who would make this objection was the fact that all of them had failed, and not just some of them. That'll soon be Paul's point. Paul's answer to this objection, reinforced by a quote from Psalm 51:4, is that God will carry out every promise He makes, no matter what man does. It's one of the great truths about God's nature. It's that He never breaks a promise. I don't know about you, but I am glad for that. What it means to me, among other things, is that God isn't going to someday get so upset with us that He's going to take back all of His promises that He's made to us and decide instead to get rid of us like He did sinful humanity in the days of Noah. Now, He's faithful. He is faithful. He will do what He says He will do. It's part of His righteous nature. Of course, we also need to note what I didn't say. I didn't say that God will keep promises that He never made. And there's a lot of people out there who hold on to promises that you won't find in Scripture. Nor did I say that He hasn't made some conditional promises. And the truth is, you and I are responsible to know the difference. God will do exactly what He says in all things. Now, the fifth objection is a spin-off of the last one, and it really is a twisting of the truth. And my paraphrase goes like this: if my sin makes God look better, shouldn't we be commended and not condemned for it? As I said, this one really is twisted. We see it raised in verses 5 and 6 where Paul writes, "But if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say? That God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us?" I'm using a human argument. Certainly not. If that were so, how could God judge the world? If this were true, if it were true that our sin serves to make God look more righteous, and that we should therefore be commended for our sin, it would mean that God has base motives. And if that was true, then he would be a sinner himself and not qualified to judge his creation. How does Paul respond to that objection? Look at verses 7 and 8. Someone might argue, if my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases his glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? Why not say, as we're being slanderously reported as saying, and as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may result? And Paul's conclusion on that matter is their condemnation is deserved. Let me read Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of these verses from the Message. He puts it this way. He says, it's simply perverse to say, if my lie serves to show off God's truth all the more gloriously, why blame me? I'm doing God a favor. So some people are actually trying to put such words in our mouths, claiming that we go around saying, the more evil we do, the more good God does, so let's just do it. That's pure slander, as I'm sure you'll all agree. Are you seeing from this how far man will go to try and keep his dirty little secret from coming out? I mean, these anticipated objections have been scraped right off the bottom of the barrel. You can't get much lower. That brings us to the final objection we're going to deal with. And this is the sixth possible objection Paul anticipates from his Jewish readers. This one says, is there any way that we Jews are better than the Gentiles, whom we know deserve God's condemnation? You see this objection raised in the first part of verse 9. What shall we conclude then? Are we any better? In other words, is there any way that we Jews are superior to the Gentiles? And Paul's answer in the second part of verse 9 is not at all. We have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. As I was studying this text, I found myself wondering if Paul's readers finally got it. And then I found myself wondering if we really got it. Do we really get this? Do we understand? See, the blunt and honest truth of the matter is that all of us are under sin. And what part of all doesn't include the religious people of the world? What part of all doesn't include the good people of this world? What part of it doesn't include the sincere people of this world? What part of all doesn't include the sweetest, nicest, most gentle grandmother baking cookies for the kids at the orphanage, or the Boy Scout who helps her across the street with her groceries? What part of all doesn't include the most pious monk who squirrels himself away in a mountain monastery, fasting each day and praying on his knees until his knees are calloused? What part of all doesn't include my loved ones and your loved ones, my godly parents and grandparents and children? What part of all doesn't include you and me? But Paul, we find ourselves saying, isn't there even one among us who isn't this way? Look again at verse 10. These are sobering words. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. But Paul, we've tried to get our act together at times. Doesn't that earn us some brownie points with God? Look at verse 11. There's no one who understands, no one who seeks God. He says they've all turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. But Paul, there are those times when I say all those nice things about God, especially on Sundays and worship services and in prayer meetings and on other occasions like that. Doesn't that count for anything, Paul? Look at verse 13. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing. But we continue to... Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery marks their ways. And the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Wow. What else can I say, Paul? I'm out of excuses. Look at verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. I read that and I was imagining it must have been like the scout's report to the fort commander after he just come back from Little Bighorn. And he's reporting the fate of General Custer and his men. And he hangs his head and he says, "All dead, sir. No survivors." But Paul, what about no survivors? He says, but surely there must be someone. No survivors. All are under sin's condemnation. Well, then tell me, Paul, how could it be that bad? I mean, didn't God give us his law so that people could keep it and be good and could please him? No, and 1,000 times no, says Paul. God did not give his law so that man could keep it and in so be made right with him. That is a common error repeated by those who don't understand the truth of the Holy Scriptures. Look at verse 20 and make sure you don't miss this. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. What does that mean? Look again. No one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. What law is Paul talking about here? If you say the law of Moses, you'd only be half right. See, no one could be justified under the law of Moses because no one could keep it perfectly, save Jesus, of course. Now ask yourself, from what we've studied so far, has there been any other law mentioned by Paul in the book of Romans? Well, sure there has. If we go back to verse 14 of chapter 2, we read these words, "Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, even now defending them." Now that, of course, raises a question. This law written on the Gentiles' heart, is it the same law of Moses? I think at best we could say it's similar. It's similar, but it's not quite the same. You see, the Gentiles' inner law, and I tried to find something to liken it to. The best I could think of was, it's kind of like instinct. So it's kind of like instinct. So the Gentiles' inner law didn't include everything that the Jews were told to do in the written law they'd received from God on Mount Sinai. It certainly wasn't as detailed or as specific. So in that sense, it wasn't quite the same law that the Jews had received. The standard for the Gentiles wasn't quite as high as that of the Jews. But remember from one of our first messages, it still condemned them because even at that, they couldn't live up to it. We sometimes miss the whole point of Paul's message to the Romans by thinking that he only meant the law of Moses couldn't justify anyone. But that just isn't true. When we look at it more closely, we find that Paul was speaking of more than that. What he was speaking about was the whole idea of law keeping in general as a means of being justified. Look again at verse 20 of chapter 3. It says, "Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin." It isn't just the law of Moses that will fail to justify man. Any and every system of law is doomed to fail to justify him. And really, the law doesn't fail. We do. We will always fail at some point when the standard of our justification is perfection. This includes, and this is what some people do with the gospel today, but this includes any remanufactured version of the gospel. It ends up being based on our ability to live up to God's standard. You see, when Jesus came and he ushered in the new covenant, it wasn't a new system of do's and don'ts substituted for an old system of do's and don'ts. Now, it was an entirely new way to be made right with God. In fact, it's the only way. It's the only way for us to be right with God. Now, let me ask you this. Which standards do you think are tougher to live up to? Those under the old covenant or under the new? Now, some of you might be surprised to discover that the new covenant standards are actually much tougher. Remember in the old covenant how God outlawed murder? Remember that? I think we'd all agree that murder is pretty brutal and definitely wrong. Well, Jesus comes along, and what's he say? He says it's just as wrong to hate somebody under the new covenant. In case you're wondering where that's found, you can find that in Matthew 5, 21 and forward. I would say that's definitely a much harder thing to do. It's a much tougher standard to abide by. I mean, how many of us here haven't hated? None of us have probably murdered anyone, at least I hope not. But how many of us have hated? Under the old covenant, we're told that committing adultery, engaging in the act of adultery, is wrong. And you know what Jesus said under the new covenant? He said, lust. Lust is just as wrong. Again, the standard is much higher. So let me ask you this. If man universally failed for thousands of years to live up to a standard that was less strict, do you now think he can live up to a newer, tougher standard? I think the answer is obvious. It's definitely no. And that's why I said the gospel is something that is entirely new and different. It's not just another system of justification by law keeping. We need to understand that actually the essence of the gospel message is that man cannot live well enough to justify himself. And that's really what the law was designed to prove. See, God knew ahead of time that the Jews could not live up to the standard of the Old Testament, and that the Gentiles couldn't live up to the standard that they knew instinctively. Well, then why did he give the law, you ask? Well, look at Paul's answer in the last part of verse 20. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. See, the law was not given to justify us. It was given to point out our sin. If truth be told, it was given to condemn us. It was given so that we'd see the results of our departure from our Maker. That's why it's called a ministry of death and a ministry of condemnation in other parts of Paul's writing. And you can see that in 2 Corinthians 3. Now, I was thinking about that. A ministry of death and condemnation. Now just imagine if a circuit type of evangelist, you know, was letting us know that he was coming to our area. You know, he was going to speak. He went to a series of evangelistic meetings, and when we asked him to tell us about his ministry, he says, My ministry is a ministry of death and condemnation. Eh? I go around the world condemning people to death. I have to be honest, I don't think he'd get very many invites. Eh? Although it sounds strange, that's exactly what the law did. And not only that, that's what it was designed to do. I mean, if there was no law, whether written or intuitive, how would we know what's right or wrong? The answer is we wouldn't. The bottom line is, if there was no right and wrong, everyone would look fine to us, right? No one would recognize wrong for what it is. And in that state, or in that kind of a condition, none of us would see our need for God. And no one would come to God. And no one would feel a need to consider returning to the one who created him, a creator, I might add, who longs for all of them to come back to him. Have you ever been estranged from someone you really loved? Maybe a family member or a close friend. I mean, something just, you know, happened between you, and you parted ways under less than ideal circumstances. And maybe you were part of the problem. Maybe you had nothing to do with it. But they just, you know, neither one of you will just, you know, admit that you were at fault or whatever. Pride just kind of, you know, gets in the way. And now a fair bit of time's gone by, and you long to see them again, and you're willing to make amends. You wish that somehow they too would just wake up, and they would miss you as much as you missed them, and just come home so you could show them all the love that you have for them, and not because you're forcing them to come, but because they choose to come. If only there was something to wake them up and realize how much you miss them. Well, folks, that's largely why God gave us the law. It shows us our true condition before him. God's hope all along has been that once we as human beings understand that and we recognize our need, that we will come to him once again. Well, we've come to a part in our text where God is about to reveal something very special to us. See, God's verdict forces man to the end of his rope. His dirty little secret is out. His rebellion is exposed. His mouth has been firmly shut to all possible objections and excuses. There is no out for him. If he dies in his sin, he's justly condemned forever. As Paul puts it in verse 19, every mouth is silenced and the whole world is held accountable to God. But then, just when it seems that there is no hope for humanity, we are told of another way. A way that does not depend on you and I being perfect. It's a way that works. Look at verse 21. But now, a righteousness from God, apart from the law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. Isn't that incredible? And we're going to unpack all that means next week on Thanksgiving Sunday. And I'm trusting even now that it is going to give each and every one of us the best possible reason ever for wanting to give thanks this Thanksgiving season. But for now, based on what we've looked at so far, as we come to our communion service, could I encourage you even now to do so recognizing that our sin separates us from God, could I encourage you to come to the communion table with this fresh sense of awareness of what God has done for you and for me in Jesus Christ? Could I encourage you to be incredibly thankful throughout this entire week for providing a way for us, a way that cost Jesus his life? Father, this morning, we had to hear the bad news before we could come to the good news. And Lord, the reality is the bad news is it's horrible. It's deplorable. Lord, I'm sure as we read some of those words by Paul and poison of vipers and our throats are open graves, some of us want to say, not me, not me, not me. But Paul says that's an all-inclusive description of humanity. So we had to hear the truth. We have to know that. We have to understand that, because otherwise, again, because of how we're wired, we will take for granted what has been done for us in Jesus. Lord, my prayer for this body of believers here this morning is that none of us, not a single one of us, from the youngest to the oldest, will take for granted the price that was paid for our justification. And the reality is that when you look at us through the shed blood of Jesus, you declare us to be perfect in Him, in Him. And all God's people said, amen.